welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy.
And today we're going to be talking about the ransomware that came out yesterday. That was a big deal. We're going to talk about your network engineering project. And then we're going to talk about our Kali Linux book and my Kali Linux projects that I'm working on. So the WannaCry ransomware came out yesterday, and this was a really big deal. And it's targeting Windows systems. And so the recommendation to fix this particular issue is to make sure you have your Windows updates applied. So you want to talk about what happened to you at work?
Yeah, actually, let's go back to what WannaCry is. Basically, it's a ransomware that grabs a hold of your files and demands 300 Bitcoin to release your files. And basically, it started in Spain, and then it moved to the UK, and it really hit their health system. They were having major problems. They couldn't take doctor's appointments. They had to cancel a bunch of those. They couldn't even do surgeries because the doctors couldn't even get into the patient file to see what kind of blood type they would have. So, you know, some of that was really serious, and they thought that they were the target of this. But what they realized rather quickly is that this thing was global. I mean, no one really kind of got exempt from this. It was all over the place. So for me, that I'm not an IT user, I got this email, and it wasn't your typical mail, like, be careful where you click on. It was like, do not click on things that you don't understand or you don't know. Be aware. It was a little more of a specific thing. It was presented at, this is a global cyber attack, beware kind of thing. So, you know, you could tell that it was a little bit different and that something big had happened. I know for you it was a little bit different because you were in the IRC. You know, you got your group of people that you guys are all supportive over your IT stuff, and you were in IRC, and you have your friend from security. So how did that went down?
So first, I want to comment on what you're saying there. I think it's important for people to understand that you are not in IT, and yet you still got this email from IT.
Right.
Saying, hey, don't click on stuff you don't, if you're not sure where it came from, don't click on it.
Right.
I think that's important because you're the end user, and this goes to end user training from the security side of things, from the IT side of things. If I let my end users know, if I'm the IT person managing all of that, hey, I want to let my users know that there's this security risk out there, be extra careful today. We don't want you to get infected. Because if the end user gets infected, that's the most vulnerable system because you're the one clicking on random things.
The problem is, and this is one of the biggest things in security, the most vulnerable thing in security is the end user. And I don't think that anybody could agree or disagree with this statement because I was actually watching Kevin Mitnick the other day. And he says, you know, people know not to plug in a USB and say, print me this or print me that. But you know what, though? If I grab a USB and I say, payroll wages for everybody in section, you know, the accounting section, and I put that somewhere, some nosy Parker is going to grab that thing. I want to go, ooh, I want to know how much so-and-so makes. And they'll plug in that puppy. So end-user education is so big. And I work in an agency where a lot of people are resistant to IT. And they don't really understand how severe this is. And they were actually talking about it in the office. But let's go back to how you found out on your IRC.
Right. So I have an IRC channel that I'm in. And I check it every so often to see what's going on. Because I have friends in IT that are part of that. And there's one guy in there who's in security, and he's really good about letting people know what's going on in security, what vulnerabilities are out there, things that we should be aware of. So people pay attention to what he has to say. So he comes in the other day, and he announces this thing, and he says, you know, here it is, kind of. And we're all kind of like, oh, hey, it's another announcement from him. He wants us to know what's going on. This is something we can, you know, maybe I can just save this for later. I'm good.
Do you think it was a warning?
Well, we didn't know what it was at first.
No, but I mean, did you think it was like, oh, here he is telling us about the latest vulnerability, blah, blah, blah?
Well, yeah, because he generally does that. So it wasn't a shock to see him say something about a potential vulnerability or a virus or a whatever. So I kind of was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And there were actually other people that kind of commented on that and were kind of like, oh, here he is again with this other, you know, exploit or whatever, warning, here he goes again. And he actually throughout the day was posting about this. So that's when we kind of all changed our tune and was like, wait a minute, he keeps talking about this. He's talking about all of Europe getting attacked, and he's talking about different companies, large ones that may have been affected by this. Maybe we should pay attention. And that's when I started seeing stuff online, Twitter, Facebook, it's all over the place. CNN was reporting on this. So
do you look in us-certs.gov? That's our alert thingy.
So yeah, let's talk about that. So US cert, or it's at us-cert.gov, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Right.
That's a great resource. You know, they have all kinds of information about different vulnerabilities that are out there, recommendations for making sure you stay safe. And of course, this particular ransomware was on there as well. They talk about this, what it is, things you can do to make yourself safe. So if you want to know more about that, this is a great place to go. People who are in the security industry will often check this site on a regular basis to stay up to date with what's going on. So it's a great place to go to.
It tells you the level of the vulnerability, if there is any patching or what's been done, what you need to do, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff in there, and they have all kinds of great resources on there. We will talk about this more in the future because I think it's one of those places where if you don't go anywhere else and this is the only place you go, you're going to know a lot about what's going on in the security and vulnerability situations that are going on out there.
So we'll have the link in the show notes. So anyway, your friend?
So yeah, he was doing all of this, and he actually had some tools that he was using to check and see if he had vulnerable systems, because that's one of the things he wanted to know. Hey, are any of my systems vulnerable? Do I need to patch them? And so he was going around checking things, and I'm assuming he had people helping him patch those vulnerable systems. And again, we're mostly looking at this was targeting Windows systems, so he's going around and looking at specific ports to figure out what's happening here.
When Windows realized this, though, they did put a patch in March of this year.
Right. So there are some things you can do to check and see if your systems are vulnerable. And one of the things that I would like to do is go back and take a look at those tools he was talking about and see how they actually work, just for learning purposes, to see how you do that. But, for most of the situations you find yourself in where things like this happen, a vulnerability is discovered, malware is out there that can take advantage of that. What are you going to do? Patch your system. I mean, we're not, there are ways to minimize the damage if there is no patch. But for most of what we need is updates to our software to get rid of that particular vulnerability. That's really the only safe option you have. Again, we'll be talking about other solutions you can use to minimize the damage. Say, for example, a firewall or antivirus software. Or maybe you have...
You can do security in layers and different things like that. But, your patching is important. It's basic. It's something that should be a part of that. And, a lot of us that are at home and we're like, oh, gosh, the little pop-up comes up and goes, do the updates and then restart your computer. And you're like, I don't want to restart my computer right now. I'll just do it later. When it comes to this, please don't do it later. Do it now. Make sure you're safe. And, hopefully you can avoid what others haven't been able to do. So anyway.
So let's talk about your network engineering project. How are you doing with that?
Okay. So I'm sure that everybody knows, but I'm just going to go over it a little bit. When I was studying for my Network Plus, the book just wasn't enough because there are things that unless you get practical experience on it, you really can't make sense of the answers. So one of the things that Damien thought was, I'm going to give you some projects, that relate to the subjects on Network Plus so you can actually put them into practice and then later on take an assessment and see where you're at. I'm getting close to take my test. So one of the things that he did is he gave me a bunch of networking questions on different subjects of the Network Plus. And I had the last set of questions that I needed to answer, and those were in the firewall project. And as everybody knows, I use pfSense for my firewall. So the questions were like, does a particular interface have DHCP? Do you have any static IP addresses in any of the interfaces? What is it that, how do you add an interface into pfSense? Things like that. So I went ahead and I decided, okay, well, in order for me to be able to answer the questions based on the project that I had done before, I needed to get into pfSense. So because my lab is a lab environment, I didn't have DHCP, so I needed to make sure that the IP address on my laptop was on a network, you know, at the network where PFSense was at, so I could actually try to get into it. So I went ahead, I turned off the wireless from my Linux machine to make sure that it didn't interfere and gave it another IP address. And I went ahead and I chose an address from the same network as PFSense, and I added it statically to my Linux machine. I went ahead just to test it, pinged. No host reachable. I couldn't get to it. I'm thinking, well, that's kind of odd. You know, they're in the same network. I don't understand. So, you know, I'm checking, am I plugged in? I'm plugged in. Are my ports on? My ports are on. You know, I'm just kind of going through all the checklists. And you know, at one point, Damien goes, well, check to see, you know, what's on your routing table. So I did route-n, looked, and sure enough, I didn't have the default gateway in there. So when we get, you know, some kind of IP address on how to get there, okay, I added the default gateway on it. Still tried to ping, couldn't reach it. I mean, it was like there's nothing I could do to reach in there. And I thought, well, maybe when we were doing the spanning tree project, I may have changed the IP address on the PFSense part of the LAN. So I'm going to go and try to get through it from a different network. And I had three networks on the last project. So I went to network B, picked an address on that network, and tried to reach the PFSense. Ping, nothing. You know, went ahead through all the same steps. Am I plugged in? Is this on? You know, the default gateway, route-n. I just couldn't reach it. So finally, after 45 minutes of frustration, I said to Damien, you know, I've done pretty much everything that I could do, and I don't understand why this is not working out. And the first thing he says to me, well, is your firewall on? And I'm like, my ports are lit. Look. And he goes, is it on in the front? And I'm like, in my mind, you know, I didn't say anything to him at the time, but in my mind, I was like, why wouldn't it be on? I mean, it had to be on for the ports to be on. So sure enough, I look in the front and the on button is not on. And I can't figure out how in the world my ports are on when the button in the front is not. So at all this, I asked Damien, how is this possible? And do you want to explain why?
So in this case, and I haven't checked to see if this particular system does this, but I'm assuming it does, and we'll have to check to make sure. But there are computer systems out there that when you plug them in, the network interface card is activated. It has power. The reason for that is that you can remotely turn on a system from the network. So what you would do in this case is you would go into the BIOS, configure the network interface card to turn on the system, and then you would have your remote computer, whether it's your laptop, your tablet, your workstation, you have some software in there that will allow you to send out a magic packet. And the magic packet goes to that particular system and tells the system, hey, turn yourself on. And then it powers on the system. So you don't have to actually be there to turn it on. You can do it remotely.
And the reason why I didn't see that is because this little machine, you know, the PFSense, it has the ports in the back and then the on button is in the front. So I have the ports facing me trying to plug these things in there. Not granted, it's not an excuse. I should have looked in the front as well. But this is a perfect example that as a newbie, it's extremely frustrating. I would have not known that the ports could be active in the back without the firewall being on. I would have sat in there for hours on end trying to figure out, and there is no Google thing that I could put on my browser to find the answer to that. And this is the frustrating part about IT, and the reason why I'm lucky to have you to tell me that, because you have the experience and you have seen this before. But for some of our listeners that are new like me, that are trying to learn IT, and they're going to be frustrated with all this, my contribution to Section 9 is going to be this. When I run into these things, I want to share them with everybody, because then that way, if I can save you the 5 hours that I would have been pulling my hair and clearing a space in the room and crying, I will do that. And it's just, and I understand that you, on your high level stuff, when you do your experience part, you're always going to come up with these things. And a perfect example was, you know, your Kali Linux project. Why don't you share with everybody the issues that came up on your project?
So, yeah, last week you talked about how IT projects always run into some kind of an issue, right? They always take longer than you expect them to. There's always something that's going to be a little bit more complicated than you expect it to be. And that's what happened to me. So we have our Kali Linux book that you got. the Kali Linux, let's see, where's the name of it here? Basic Security Testing with Kali Linux 2. And this came out in 2016, so last year. And so I opened it up and I went ahead and took a look at the table of contents. And there's a section there where they have some information about virtual machines that you should have in order to follow along in the book. So they have Kali Linux, of course. They want you to use VMware Player. And then they also have Metasploitable 2 and Windows 7. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, okay, I have some of this, but let's review here. Let's think about this for a minute. There are some issues here. And this is something that you have to take into consideration. When you get a book like this, you need to check the date and you need to check and see, hey, is the software something that you have access to? Is it up to date? Is it out of date? Is this old software that you don't have access to anymore? So these are things you have to think about when you get an IT book.
Well, that was the best thing that you ever taught me because, you know, we would go to Barnes & Noble and he would go, look at the date when the book came out. And I'm like, God, you know what? Things are not going to change. The basics of, and he would say to me, no, you don't understand. IT moves really fast. And you can be reading a book and it's telling you how to do a specific lab, for example. And if your software has been updated or, you know, changes have been made because, I mean, things in IT move rather fast, all of a sudden what you're trying to do is not going to work. So that was one of the best things that you ever taught me when it came to not only getting the most updated information when it comes to IT, but not to buy a book and sit in there for the next 300 years and think that I can read it a year from now and be up to whatever's going on. So, you know, that was, I just wanted to say that because that to me was very valuable.
Yeah. So in this particular case, I don't think it's going to be a major issue.
Right.
So first of all, we can still use most of this. I'm not entirely sure what we're going to do about Windows 7, but I'm going to have to figure that out. So here's the situation that, well, here are the steps that I took in order to sort of resolve some of this. I went to the simple option first, and I decided I was going to update my Kali Linux installation. Now, in my case, I have this installed as a virtual machine on our ESXi server, because our ESXi server has snapshots. It's always there. I can use it for multiple things. I can be on different systems and still have access. So that's why I have it there. And you also have your own Kali Linux virtual machine there as well. And one thing I want to mention here is that for our Linux systems, we have this thing called apt-cacher-ng. And this works for apt-based systems. So we have Debian is an apt-based system. Ubuntu is an apt-based system. Kali Linux uses apt. And there are a few other distributions out there that use the apt package manager. So whenever you want to install an application, what do?
Apt-get.
And then whatever the package is that we want to install. So the nice thing about having apt-cacher-ng in a lab like this is that every time I install an application or I do updates for Kali Linux, it's going to save the updates on apt-cacher-ng. And the next person or the next time I need to update something, it's right there. It's on the network. I don't have to go to the internet to get that. So I don't have to wait for the updates to happen.
So what you're saying is that you have this in the apt-get cache, right? It gets the updates in there. And if I wanted to use it, I can just get it with the updates already. I don't have to go to the internet to download them.
Correct. So like when you get around to using your Kali Linux virtual machine, which is probably out of date because you haven't been using it for a while, when you go and you do apt update, apt dist-upgrade, it's going to check the apt-cacher server. If apt-cacher has the packages already on the system,
right,
it's just going to serve them up to you.
Oh, nice.
And you won't have to go to the internet to get them. Because there's going to be a lot of updates.
Does Windows have that?
Windows has something similar to that.
And can you use that in an enterprise environment?
So for apt-cacher-ng, you would be able to use this in an enterprise environment because you're going to have multiple systems out there. You may not want all of them to go to the internet. Same thing with the Microsoft side of things. They have that in there, and that's actually the recommended way to do that.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, we have that for us. Works out really great because I don't have to wait for these large updates to complete because I've already got that. So let's say, for example, I mess up my Kali Linux installation. I need to reinstall it for some reason. I can reinstall, do my apt update, apt dist-upgrade, and then it's going to just give me the upgrade or the updates from the network. I don't have to go download them from the internet.
Nice.
Speeds up the process.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and update this thing. So I typed in my commands to do that, and I run into some issues. Whenever you update or upgrade Linux, there's always going to be some software there that requires you to do some sort of a configuration. So there was a couple things that came up, and I'm looking at these and I'm thinking, what is that? I've never seen this application before. I've never seen this software before. What do I do? So I had to go online and do some searching, find out what this is, and then make a decision. Those are some things that you have to take into consideration when you do this. Now, fortunately for me, these were applications that you're going to use for hacking into something. So they're tools. So, you know, the first one I said no to, and I think that had something to do with changing MAC addresses. Well, I don't want to do it all the time. I want to do it manually. So I said no to that. And then there was another one for another piece of software, and it wanted to put in, or you wanted to know what you wanted to do with the configuration file. So I just took the package maintainer's configuration file, and then I can go ahead and change that if I decide to use that particular application.
Nice.
So not a big deal, but it was one that required me to do some homework, do some research, and make decisions on how these things are going to be installed and configured.
And that is, you know, it happens at your level as well as a newbie level that, you know, it's never like you open the book, set up the lab, and everything works pretty. There are times that you can just get caught up on one little spot and have to do some research as well as trying to figure out why one thing is turned on and the other one isn't. But anyway.
So now we can talk about Metasploitable 2. I think Metasploitable 2 is going to work fine, but there's also Metasploitable 3. So what's the difference here? Metasploitable 2, my understanding is that that was kind of their test system. So what this is all about is you need to have a vulnerable system to be able to learn how to hack into something. We have hacking tools. Now, how do we use them? Well, the only way you can really learn that is by hacking into something. And that's why we have things like Metasploitable 2. There are other virtual machines out there or systems that you can get that are vulnerable and you can use them. They're perfectly fine. In this case, I need Metasploitable 2 because that's what the book says. I already have that. What about Metasploitable 3? Well, I'd like to use that. Why? 3 is more advanced. They have some easy things that you can do to hack into the system. And then if you want to gain more access to the system, you're going to have to do more work to do that. It's not as simple as just saying, press a button, hack in, oh, I have full access to the system, which I think is what you get with Metasploitable 2. So we'll be talking about these systems as I go through and play around with these things and figure out how they work. So there's a problem here with this whole setup, though. First, I have to learn how to install Metasploitable 3 if I'm going to use that. The requirements are different. So the book says you need VMware Player. Okay, fine. I can install Metasploitable 2 in VMware Player, which I already have. 7 can be installed in VMware Player. That's okay. So what about Metasploitable 3? Well, that's different. You have to build it from scratch. There's a bunch of stuff you have to do. And you need VirtualBox to do this. You can't do it on VMware Player. It doesn't work. So now I got to install VirtualBox. I have to follow some instructions on how to get Metasploitable 3 configured and built. There's some scripts for that. You can get that from GitHub. So there's a lot of stuff I'm going to have to do in order to figure out how to get that installed. So it's more homework. And as we talked about again last episode, you were talking about how these IT projects just take forever. So I'm in a situation now where I can do some of the things in the book with Metasploitable 2, but I can't use 3 until I figure out how to actually get that installed. I've got to do some homework. So instead of just going through the book like I wanted to and having this being a simple process, now there's a whole bunch of extra stuff I have to do to set up my security lab to learn how this stuff works.
Well, that's kind of a perfect example, because if the book just asks you to do Metasploitable 2, but now Metasploitable 3 is out and it has a lot more tools, if you were in a work environment trying to implement some of these things, you have to know about Metasploit 3, right? Or Metasploitable 3. So, you know, and that's one of the things that, again, the book is not that old. It's March of 2016. And yet, you know, all of this has changed. So it's a good example of showing how that.
Yeah. And now we have to talk about Windows 7. Because not too long ago, you could get a copy of Windows 7, a trial copy, from one of Microsoft's websites. And you could just download it. Anybody could do that. I'm not so sure you can do that anymore because Windows 7 is not supported anymore. Now, I do have access at work to the Volume Licensing Center, which is where Microsoft has all their software. You download it, and then whatever you use, you have to pay for. But Windows 7 is still there, so I could get it that way. The other option is to forget Windows 7, maybe try Windows 10. So again, here's another situation where the book's not that old, but the software they're recommending, it may be difficult for you to figure out how you're going to get that.
And how hackable is Windows 10 going to be? Because it's a lot more secure than Windows 7 and Windows 8. You know, so while maybe Windows 7 has some vulnerabilities that you can actually tap into, will you be able to do that on Windows 10, even on an unpatched version? I mean, I guess if it's not totally patched, but I mean, I don't know.
That's going to be the difficult challenge there. Yeah. And that's why when you're getting into security and doing security labs, these are the challenges that come up. And since we're learning how to use these different tools, Windows 10 may be one of those situations where we can't do it because we don't know enough yet.
Right.
So, and Windows 7, I've used that in the past where I can use an unpatched older version of Windows 7 and Metasploit to attack Windows 7 and be able to get in.
Yeah.
Can we do that on 10? I don't know. I've never tried it.
Well, even if you're doing pen testing and things like that, you're going to have to know if not only if it works on Windows 7, but you're going to have to know if it works on the latest operating system. So it's not something you can ignore. I guess my thought would have been, oh, let's do all of this, you know, as the book says, only Metasploitable 2 on Windows 7 and see if it works. And then trying to say, okay, what were the changes and how is it different on trying to do it with Metasploitable 3 on Windows 10?
Right, right. So that's kind of what I'm working on for the security side of things, learning how that works. One thing I would like to mention is I had this interesting back and forth with somebody on LinkedIn. They posted something about their hacking experience in their lab and then what they're trying to accomplish with that. And they were asking for recommendations for different tools and things that they may want to have on their lab. And so my comment was this. It's nice that you have your hacking tools on something like Kali Linux, and then you have something like Metasploitable 2 or Metasploitable 3, and then you have two systems, one with your tools and one you're going to hack into. That's nice. But that's not what it looks like in the real world.
Exactly.
So what I said is this. It's nice you have that. You're going to learn something from that. I'm doing that. I'm going to learn a lot from that because I don't know how to use these tools very well. The problem I have is that when you're on the outside looking into the network, what do you see? All kinds of things. There is a firewall. There's intrusion detection systems. There are multiple subnets and VLANs. And the system you want is buried in there somewhere. So how are you going to attack that system? What are the steps you're going to use to get there? And I think when you look at it from that perspective, from the outside looking in, all bets are off. All the things that you might want to do when you have the vulnerable system right in front of you, they're totally different. It makes you think differently.
Well, and that is the reason why I keep saying episode after episode how crucial knowledge of networking is for information security when you're trying to defend a network, or when you're trying to see if you can pen test a network. If you do not understand or know that a network's going to have a firewall, an intrusion detection, you know, all sorts of different things, and it's going to be layer after layer. If you do not understand that, how are you going to get through all of that? Even, you know, knowing and having the experience with the tools, you know, it's a big old joke about, you know, oh, this guy is a sex consultant, you know. He knows all sorts of ways of knowing how to have sex, but doesn't know any women. It's the same concept, you know. You sit in there, you can have all the hacking tools in the world. If you do not understand how the network works, you're not getting in. That's just how it works. So I think networking is very important. And if you cannot understand how a network works, you can't defend it any more than you can penetrate it. And this is how it works.
Yeah. So anything else you want to talk about?
Nope. But I think that's it for me.
So yeah, we're going to continue working on our projects. It's going to be difficult. We're going to run into all kinds of issues. I think that's pretty much it. If you have, or if you want to take a look at some of our show notes, you can take a look at them at section9.us. If you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us.
Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening.